KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. As President Donald Trump feuds with his own Secretary of State and the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, my guest will be Consul on Foreign Relations scholar Stephen Cook. We'll check in with him about the latest news out of Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran, and his new book. We'll talk about it. It's called False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. That's next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As the United States grapples with major foreign policy challenges over North Korea and Iran, a feud between President Donald Trump and his Secretary of State Rex Tillerson continues. The president is also engaged in a social media war with Robert Corker, chairman of the Senate's Committee on Foreign Relations. In this hour, Consul on Foreign Relations senior fellow Stephen Cook joins us in the studio to talk about the latest foreign policy developments and his new book, False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. And welcome, Stephen Cook.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. Not by phone here, but in the flesh, indeed. Let me say some things before we go into some current news. I want to talk with Stephen about his book, which does some excellent analysis about what happened in the Arab Spring. And put this out as a little bit of tease to you, our listeners, because you can remember the discussions and the heightened vitality in 2011 when the Arab Spring took place. And the question he tries to get at answering in the book is why it failed, why there was no true revolutions in the Middle East, why none of the societies underwent social revolutions, and why the old power structures remain. And we'll get to that. But first, let's get to some things that we want to talk about that are very much in the news. And I teased this with talking about the difficulty of the President of the United States communicating not only with the Secretary of State, allegedly being called a moron by the Secretary of State, which he called fake news. Now he's talking about them having an IQ rivalry. And with Senator Corker, I mean, what do you make of this, and particularly in terms of the Middle East, where there's all kinds of crises going on?
Well, it is sadly become the norm in Washington over the course of the last eight and a half or nine months that we wake up to the president taking to Twitter. But we've grown more used to the president going after, whether it's NFL players or the leader of North Korea. It's a little more shocking to see the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the president having a Twitter war as they have had over the weekend. I think what it does is it impairs the ability of the United States to conduct a coherent foreign policy, and it raises all kinds of questions in world capitals about the United States, its credibility, and whether the United States can continue to play the role that it has played. That is something extremely important to Washington's traditional allies in the Middle East. It's no secret that the countries in the Gulf, Egypt and Israel, very much welcomed the election of President Trump, believing that under President Trump, the United States would demonstrate kind of traditional leadership in the region. If you are sitting in Riyadh or Abu Dhabi or Jerusalem or Cairo, seeing all of this kind of thing unfold has to raise questions for you about the ability of the United States to conduct, as I said, a coherent foreign policy.
Well, you know, there was a coherent foreign policy with respect to Iran. There was essentially a deal that was brokered, and now it's coming up for certification, and I think President Trump has given every indication that he does not intend to certify it. So we're getting into perhaps even more tumultuous territory here, or more unpredictability. But there's also a threat that's been put out recently by the Revolutionary Guard, where they said essentially if they are designated as a terrorist group, I mean, they threatened the United States if that should happen, and apparently it's on the brink of happening.
Well, I think that there's very little doubt that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is a terrorist organization with all of the support it lends to groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and others around the region, including the Taliban. But
But they've said if they're so designated, they've said that they would treat the United States like ISIS treats the United States.
Well, yes. I think that this is a significant amount of bravado on the part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, although we should take it very, very seriously given our presence in the Middle East. But I think that this speaks to this question. There has been a lot of tough rhetoric in Washington about Iran. There's been a lot of tough rhetoric about the decertification of the Iran nuclear deal. And this is the kind of response that the Trump administration should expect. I think that oftentimes the president makes a statement or his subordinates make a statement without thinking through how this statement will be received and how the target of these statements will respond. And this is the perfect example in which the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is threatening the United States, Americans, and American interests in the region.
What's happening, in your judgment, with Turkey? I mean, there's a whole question now about visa exchanges, and Turkey has started pushing into a buffer south of Turkey on the border with Syria, and this means alliance, presumably. In fact, there's a memorandum that back in May of an alliance, right, with Russia and with Iran.
We can spend hours talking about Turkey, Michael. The two main issues with regard to Turkey is, first, that the Turks, along with the Russians and the Iranians, have agreed to establish de-escalation zones in Syria. The one in which the Turks are going to be responsible for is Idlib, which is a center of jihadist and extremist activities. And they have begun to push into this area and establish a responsibility for a de-escalation of the violence in that area. This is essentially paving the way to allow the central government in Syria, the Assad regime, to reestablish control over Syria, which is a tremendous change for the Turks. That change is born out of the fact that the Syrian Kurds, allies of the United States, are enemies of the Turks, and the Turks have been driven to work with the Russians and the Iranians if they want to secure their interests in Syria.
Turkey's more interested in doing something to the Kurds than it is in stopping the Islamic State.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you go back to the assault on Kobani in 2014, the Turks were very, very clear that their primary interest was ensuring that Syrian Kurds do not realize their objective of establishing some sort of autonomous or even independent state in northern Syria. And that has been their goal ever since. At times, their interests have aligned with extremist groups such as the Islamic State. At other times, it hasn't. But they have moved closer to the Russians, if only because the Russians are the power brokers in Syria, and they need Russian help in preventing the Syrian Kurds from realizing their objectives.
One could assume moving closer to the Russians would mean moving farther away from the United States. Were it not for a president who seems to want to move very close to the Russians, one can't even predict in that vein what's going on. But also, you know, it occurs to me that if it weren't for North Korea and Iran, the major story in the news would be Yemen. There's a major civil war raging in Yemen. And now we've got a lot of celebrities and people like Noam Chomsky and Lawrence Tribe who have signed essentially who are trying to change congressional attitude toward helping Saudi Arabia in Yemen. You see anything moving forward along those lines?
Well, there is some significant unhappiness in the Congress about supplying weaponry to the Saudis in order to prosecute their intervention.
That, again, is a Trump principle, if there's any kind of principle or coherence to Trump's foreign policy. Let's help the Saudis, yeah?
Well, that's exactly right. And this is what I was alluding to before, that the Saudis were so pleased with the election of Donald Trump because there was a sense that he would support them to the hilt. And one of the places that they would support them is in their intervention in Yemen, which has gone on for a number of years now. Yemen is a country that is on the brink of famine. The World Health Organization recently upped its estimate and believes that as many as 1 million people could be affected by cholera. Now, it is essentially one of, if not the wealthiest country in the region, attacking the poorest country in the region. This is extraordinary. And with American weaponry and with American assistance. Under President Obama, there was American assistance. It was a little bit more ambivalent than it is now. But nevertheless, this is a continuum of American policy. The Obama administration did this as a way of demonstrating to the Saudis that it continues to support Saudi Arabia and Saudi security as it was negotiating a nuclear deal with Iran, Saudi Arabia's archenemy.
We're talking to Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and has a new book out called False Dawn. He appears tonight, 6:30 p.m. at the World Affairs Council. And let's go into False Dawn here. I want to talk some more with you about Iraq and ongoing current events.
Sure.
But the notion that the dawn that had come simply went and has been foreshadowed now, or overshadowed, I should say, by darkness in many respects in the Middle East. What happened? I mean, you go through kind of a list of each country, and each country is different in its own way. And Tunisia is always held out as, you know, sort of the beacon
right.
that's come through. But I think you said correctly, there are successes in Tunisia, but it's very fragile, and there are also failures in Tunisia. But most of these countries, particularly Syria, there was a thought that Assad would be overturned the same way that Mubarak was overturned. Now we've got Assisi, who essentially is very much like Mubarak.
Right.
We've still got Assad, and we still have chaos in the Middle East.
It's a rather extraordinary story. There was so much hope. There was so much exhilaration. There was the romance of the barricades. There was a belief that the Middle East would end up like the countries of Central and Eastern Europe back in 1989 and 1990 and 1991 and make a relatively smooth transition to democracy. Clearly, that hasn't happened. And I focus on, and you mentioned it in your very nice opening, there were no real revolutions in these countries. You had uprisings that chased leaders from power, but new leaders quickly emerged. You mentioned Abdel Fattah Sisi, the president of Egypt, is a military officer just like Hosni Mubarak. That the regimes, the political systems, and the social orders that support those systems never faltered. And it allowed leaders like military officers in Egypt or representatives of the old guard in Tunisia to undermine those people who wanted to live in more democratic and open societies.
The usual interpretation of this is, and I want to talk about Libya, too, because
sure.
Libya is just, as you say in your book, descending into chaos all the time, probably even as we speak. But the usual answer to that is they didn't have democratic structures, that was really the problem. Or terrorism, you know, and jihadists made it impossible to move toward any kind of reasonable governing bodies. But I think you go deeper into the reasons and talk about that.
Well, it's not just that they didn't have democratic structures or that there wasn't a strong tradition of democratic politics in these countries. It's that the political institutions of the state, and what I mean by that in the book, the rules, the regulations, the laws written down reflected the interests of those people who had been in power for a long time. And thus, when Hosni Mubarak, for example, was driven from power, and in the interim, the head of the military, Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, took over executive power, he had the very same political system, the very same means, the very same rules, laws, decrees, and regulations that he could use to undermine the revolutionary youth, the liberals, the secularists, the Muslim Brotherhood, who wanted to live in a different kind of society. The point, one of the big points of the book is that it's not so much that Gaddafi fell or that Ben Ali in Tunisia fell or Mubarak fell. It's what was left in their wake politically and how that
institutionally really. Yeah, yeah.
And how that had an impact on politics going forward. And if we had not been so enthralled by these uprisings, we might have seen this clearer, and we would have expected something different. Actually, we'd have expected what has happened rather than being surprised that these countries didn't make transitions to democracy.
What's happened is we've got a pretty grim picture now of authoritarianism and repression and violent, unstable regimes that are probably likely to continue.
Yeah, I think that that's the case. One of the things that policymakers and analysts used to say about the Middle East is that it was marked by authoritarian stability. I think going forward, we need to think about the region in terms of authoritarian instability.
Again, let's get back to Turkey, though, because Turkey was considered to be a democracy in the ocean of all this stability from tyranny or stability from despotism, whatever you want to call it. Under Erdogan, there was a sense that at least some of those institutions that had been fairly long in Turkey were going to endure. They're not enduring.
Yeah, I think one of the great tragedies of Turkey is that after a short period, a burst of important political reform,
and a coup that failed.
But early on in Erdogan's tenure, there was a burst of political reform, so much so that the European Union offered Turkey a formal invitation to begin negotiations to join the EU. If there was any marker that Turkey was taking significant steps towards becoming a democracy, that was it. 12, 13, 14 years later, it's become clear that Turkey actually is anything but a democracy, and that those political institutions that had been used to repress people like President Erdogan, he himself is now using to repress his opponents and establish control over the 50% of the Turkish population that doesn't actually support him or his party.
Do you see Erdogan as essentially a kind of, radical Islamist deep down? Particularly in light of the fact that we talked about him going into Syria now essentially to support Assad, who mostly receives his support from Shias as opposed to Sunni, which is what Erdogan is.
It's a kind of amazing set of contradictions if you think about Erdogan. But he is not a kind of radical Islamist. He is an old-fashioned authoritarian and Turkish nationalist. He certainly envisions a transformation of Turkey where religion plays a greater role in society, and that's the Turkey that he has sought to forge. He believes that the secularizing principles and values of the Turkish Republic that was founded by Ataturk in the early 1920s are essentially alien to Turkish society, and he has vowed to undermine those values and bring forth a more religiously oriented but not theocracy in Turkey. In his effort to secure Turkey's interests in Syria, he is working with people with whom he never believed he would be forced to work, including Bashar al-Assad. Although I will point out, early on in Assad's tenure, he did make a very strong effort to cultivate the Assad regime, establish good relations with Syria, which they very much did, in an effort, one, to peel the Syrians away from the Iranians, as well as also for trade purposes. If you opened up Syria from their perspective, you opened up the rest of the region to Turkish traders.
Our guest is Stephen Cook, and once again, he's a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Let me give out the phone number, and let's hear from you, our listeners. We're talking about his book, False Dawn, also talking about current events within the Middle East and trying to get a fix on Trump foreign policies with respect to the Middle East. And would certainly like to hear from some of you. If you have questions or comments, in fact, you can join us now. Let me give you the toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in this conversation, and we'd like to hear from you. And again, you can join us now. Toll-free number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also join the program by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. A number of ways you can be involved in this discussion with any questions or comments you might have. You take a fairly strong position here, Stephen Cook, and that is United States should not be involved in Middle East affairs, or should be maybe minimally involved. We learned a very hard lesson, which is still very much with us with respect to Iraq. And yet, there has to be some sense of the Middle East and a role for the United States in terms of trying to keep things balanced in some way. What would that role be?
Well, I think it's important for us to recognize what is truly important to the United States in the Middle East, and I think Washington has gotten away from it. And when I say we should play a minimal role in the region, it is just my observation that the United States really doesn't have the resources available to it or the insight necessary to help resolve the kinds of intense, almost existential-type struggles that are going on in places like Libya, like Egypt, even in Tunisia, where identity politics is actually very, very important. So under those circumstances, my call in the book is for us to get back to basics. And what is it? And think about what is it important to the United States in the region. For the last 60 years, what's been important to the United States has been the free flow of energy resources out of the region, helping to ensure Israeli security. During the Cold War, it was containing the Soviet Union. Since the end of the Cold War, it's really been about ensuring that no other country dominates the region other than the United States. And then, of course, you add things like counterterrorism and counterproliferation. But in general, those few things are the things that are important and around which we should be crafting our policy. Now, maybe we should have a national conversation about whether those core interests are still valid today. Although I'm skeptical of our ability to have a national conversation, we can't seem to have a national conversation on a lot of important domestic issues to the United States. It strikes me that it'll be very hard to have a conversation about oil, Israel, and America's dominance of the Middle East.
Well, I alluded to Iraq specifically because there were terrible lessons that were learned from the United States' involvement in Iraq. Shouldn't have been there probably from the beginning, but that's a judgment that history will perhaps render one way or the other. But certainly the rise of ISIS had a lot to do with our being there. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein was removed, but for the most part now we have a regime that's in some ways very strongly tied to Iran. And, you know, yet we're moving toward perhaps some more conflict, maybe even armed conflict with Iran. It's hard to say at this point. So let me actually ask you specifically about Iraq, because you've got all these statements from the United Nations about people displaced. You've got hundreds of thousands of people displaced. And what should the United States do? What can the United States do?
I think you've captured it extremely well. The adventure in Iraq served not a single interest of the United States and injected a level of instability and violence in the region that did not exist beforehand. Now we are confronting the catastrophic success of defeating the Islamic State, at least on the battlefield. We haven't defeated the worldview or the ideology of the Islamic State.
Quite the contrary.
Quite the contrary. And we are looking at a country that, although the central government is buoyed by the fact that the Islamic State is on the run, is confronting essentially a broken country, hundreds of thousands of people displaced. There's vengeance that is being taken out against people in towns that have been liberated from the Islamic State. One can expect more violence in Iraq, as this all has kind of receded to the back pages of the major newspapers around the world. I think, however, that the United States is going to be in Iraq in larger numbers than it's been in the last 5 years. I think not. We have learned the lesson of the invasion of Iraq, but we're also learning the lesson of President Obama's withdrawal from Iraq. And the narrative is that you can't withdraw. The United States now needs to be there.
The narrative is the surge needed to continue and there needed to be more surges.
That's right.
This is particularly what we're hearing from our Republican Congress, but we'll hear more from Stephen Cook and from you, our listeners. We do invite your involvement in the program. In fact, let me go to your calls when we return. The number to call is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Again, Stephen Cook is Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called False Dawn. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour, Stephen Cook, is Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's the author of False Dawn: Protests, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. He'll be appearing at the World Affairs Council this evening at 6:30 p.m. here in San Francisco. And I want to go to your calls here. Let me go to a couple comments first and get your responses, Stephen. Kat writes, why go to war with Iran? Is Trump so indentured to the Saudis that now the U.S. is doing their dirty work in the region? Iran supports players in the Middle East that the Saudi government doesn't like. Do we label their government as a terrorist supporter so we can start a war? This smells a lot like what we did to Iraq.
Well, there's certainly the way in which people have begun to talk about Iran in Washington is reminiscent of the way in which people talked about Iraq in 2001 and 2002. And that should be a concern to everyone, given the way in which Iraq turned out. And Iran is a very different country with significant capabilities around the region. This would not be wise to go to war with Iran. I think the problem, however, is that Iran is not a benign actor in the region either. Let's keep in mind that the Iranians have enabled the murder of 400,000 people in the conflict in Syria. That conflict began as a peaceful uprising in the same way that the uprisings began in Tunisia and Libya and Egypt. And they, the Iranians, helped Bashar al-Assad militarize it. They have armed terrorist groups throughout the region. And in a broader abstract way, Iran is really a revolutionary power in the region. The United States is a status quo power. The Iranians very much want to change the rules of the road in the region. What was interesting about what President Obama wanted to do is he wanted to bring the Iranians in and give them a stake in the region so that it would reduce the tension between Iran and its neighbors and Iran and the United States. That, to many in Washington, was wise, but to an equal number of people in Washington, they believed that this was a mistake. That party won the presidential election and controls the Congress, and this is the road that we seem to be going down, but we should be very, very cautious.
I have a question about Obama's culpability in foreign policy, but before I get to that, I wanted to get to the fact that we really if we're on this, I think the caller, the listener's question gets right down to this dichotomy that we see in the Middle East now. The Saudis are very much adversarial to the Iranians and vice versa. And the United States clearly has chosen sides, haven't they, under the Trump administration?
That's exactly right. And in fact, the Trump administration has moved American foreign policy back to a place that enjoyed bipartisan support over many years, which was supporting the Saudis to the hilt and confronting the Iranians, containing the Iranians and confronting them where they would do harm. The Trump, it's not really a major change or something that is a reflection of Donald Trump himself. I think the outlier was President Obama, who saw that there was a different way of going about trying to secure the Gulf. The Gulf countries, Egypt, Israel rejected that, did everything possible to undermine those policies. And in that, they had willing allies and people in the Republican Party in the United States.
I think you just answered the next question, which was from Segev, who wanted to know how much of what's going on in the Middle East is a result of the Obama administration foreign policy. And the answer implicitly is a great deal. But let's go to our callers and let's bring Steve on as first caller here. Steve, you're on.
Hey, how you doing today?
Oh, it's Scott. I'm sorry. No, it's Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah, Steve. Yeah, so my thing is we should not be involving ourselves in the Middle East. I think the only thing we need to be doing is doing humanitarian work, providing medicine and food and shelter for those who just trying to be out of harm's way. Let those other countries have the stake in the game, like Saudi Arabia and Iran, and because if they don't have stake in the game, they don't really going to care. So as long as they're not feeling threatened by any kind of terrorist, they're not going to put any skin in the game. Let them all put skin in the game. As long as we keep being the police, they're not going to bother with it. And they're not going to solve their own problems. That's the problem. They're not solving their own problems. We keep interfering with them and keep trying to solve their problems for us, and we keep killing innocent people. Which, when you kill innocent people, you create more enemies.
Yeah, Steve, you're pretty much in line with our guest, Stephen Cook, who feels that the United States can do a great deal in humanitarian aid but shouldn't necessarily interfere. And yet we have real interest there. I mean, the argument we go, Stephen Cook, especially with petroleum.
Right. And I think that is one of those core interests that is going to keep the United States in the Middle East. It's not so much that the United States is a consumer of vast amounts of Middle Eastern oil at this point, but that we have a interest in a healthy global capitalist economic order. And as long as our major trading partners are dependent upon energy resources from the Middle East, the United States is likely to be there. But one thing that Steve pointed out was this question of skin in the game. Do the Saudis have the skin in the game? Do the Iranians have the skin in the game? And I think those countries would very much argue that they do. In particular, the Saudis have rewritten their defense doctrine in order to take into account the fact that President Obama retrenched from the region, that although President Trump has vowed to move us back to a place where we were before the Obama administration was, that there's a concern that retrenchment will continue. They have put their skin in the game, and they've done it in Yemen in a big way, and that has resulted in a total, utter disaster. And now it's up to the United States and others to try to extricate the Saudis from Yemen and try to provide that humanitarian aid. So there is a certain logic to what Steve is suggesting, but at the same time, let's not discount the fact that these countries can, left to themselves, create much more chaos than without the United States.
Let me ask you, Steve, caller, I mean, you know, there's slaughtering going on in Yemen. Should the United States just stand and be a Stephen Cook, the United States should be just a neutral observer and all that?
I don't think that the United States should be a neutral observer. I think what we should be doing is looking for ways to extricate the Saudis from Yemen. This is an unwinnable war for them. It has killed thousands, tens of thousands of people. It is a country that's on the brink of famine, widespread disease. The best thing that the United States can do for Yemen and for the Saudis and for the stability of Saudi Arabia, which is part of our interests in the stability of the region, is to get the Saudis out.
And then Yemen becomes more under the control of Iran?
Well, that's the debate, is exactly how you do that. And that one of the things that the Trump administration has said is, we would like to get the Saudis out of Yemen, but we've got to do it in a way that does not hand Yemen over to the Iranians. And that means, from their perspective, the application of force against the Iranians in Yemen.
More of your calls. Let me go next to Frank. Frank, join us.
Good morning. Great program, target-rich environment, lots to talk about. But I got through the screening on a Turkey issue, and let me stick to that, although I'd like to leave behind a question for you, Michael, regarding culpability of Obama. Does Mr. Cook think there was a point where anti-air weapons would have put Syria, would have put Assad out of office way back when? But my question to you, Mr. Cook, is, I think your levers of power argument is a little facile when it comes to saying that every country there has merely replaced one authoritarian with another. And in particular, I'd like you to compare Egypt, where definitely they substituted a general for a general, same social monetary power structure, with Turkey, where it seems that wasn't there a much more complicated series of struggles that went on? Let's put aside Gulen for a moment. But even so, against the military, the secular military, and does that have any effect, in your opinion, on the way we should be dealing with Turkey?
Great questions. First, on the question of Syria, I wrote an article in January. It was either late January or early February 2012. I can't remember. I'm getting a little old. Arguing that the United States does need to intervene in Syria, otherwise there'll be a humanitarian disaster of unimaginable proportions. I was absolutely an advocate at that moment for making it impossible for Assad's military to roll over civilians in the way that it has. As that conflict has evolved, I've reevaluated my position. I'm not quite sure at this point what the United States could have done. Beginning, let's say, back as, 2013, when President Obama contemplated intervening in Syria, what the United States could have done to other than get in the middle of someone else's civil war. Now, onto this question of Turkey, I think that, the argument that I'm trying to bring forth in the book about kind of continuity in the region is this, how it relates to Turkey. Of course, the Justice and Development Party under Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who served as prime minister and now president, altered the role of the military in the political system in Turkey. Many of us, including myself, saw this as a positive development towards Turkey's transition to democracy. But what seems to have happened, what's clear that's happened, is that Erdogan has turned around and used the institutions, the political institutions of the state, the ones that existed prior to his rise to power, in similar ways as the previous elite, the elite that he has sought to replace. And the outcome is very similar. It is an authoritarian or semi-authoritarian political system. But of course, there's been change in these places. Of course, Erdogan is a different type of authoritarian than what you had in Turkey beforehand. My point merely is that the institutions of the state have remained resilient and available to leaders to undermine their oppositions.
Frank, may I answer your questions?
I may disagree, but they definitely answered them head on. Thank you.
Right. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Busad. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, my name is Busad. I'm from Algeria. So my comment is about the involvement of the Algerian government in the peace in Tunisia and Libya, and also the French government. So, this government, they are very corrupt and they're imposing the ideology for the Arabs and the Islam in North Africa, and the big denial of the Berbers. Like in Libya, the Berbers, they did a revolution. Right now, the Berbers, everything's taken away from them, like in Algeria, all in North Africa. So my point, if North Africa didn't recognize their identity and their ethnicity, it will never have a peace.
Algeria plays a pretty significant role, as the caller is suggesting. Yes, Stephen?
Absolutely. Algeria is a country that has, over a long period of time, suppressed its Berber population. This is a phenomenon across North Africa, and I think the caller is spot on when he suggests that as long as the Berbers are suppressed and their kind of unique cultural, their language and their ways, as long as those things are not recognized by these states, there will continue to be unrest in these countries, and it'll be hard to make transitions to democracy under those circumstances.
And again, we invite you to join us on the program. We're talking to Stephen Cook, and his new book is called False Dawn. You can be a part of the program. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Let me go to some emails here. Chris wants to know, what's the role of social media in both starting and undermining the Arab Spring? Was there Russian involvement? It's a question that kind of looms now with respect to our own election and all those bots and all those trolls and so forth. Arab Spring, I mean, we had people on in the Arab Spring who say it wouldn't have taken place if it hadn't been for social media.
Well, I think that's an argument that's a little too neat. I think uprisings, revolutions often take advantage of technologies to spread the word and to organize. It certainly played an important role as a force multiplier in bringing people out into the streets. But I think we'd be hard-pressed to suggest that it's a cause of these uprisings. Now, as far as the Russians playing a role, the Russians were absolutely opposed to what was happening in the region and actually wanted to partner with the United States to put down, to use their influence to put down uprisings, fearing that it would bring Islamists and Islamic extremism to the fore in the region. So I'm hard-pressed to believe that there was any kind of Russian involvement and Russian infiltration of Arab social media during the uprisings.
I've got a few more questions coming in by email. Joe wants to know, how much of the chaos in the Middle East now can be traced to the policies of the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War?
Well, I think without a doubt, if you look at Afghanistan, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the American efforts to arm the opposition out of the Mujahideen, from which al-Qaeda and other extremist groups emerged, there is certainly what they refer to as blowback. The invasion of Iraq certainly has had an enormous impact on stability and the emergence of extremism around the region. In the same way that the Russians, in order to put down uprisings in Chechnya, for example, have also radicalized politics in those countries, created instability, and produced extremists who want to use violence. So I think both countries are culpable of injecting instability into sensitive regions, accentuating conflicts there, identity conflicts, and allowing extremism and extremists, allowing extremism to flourish and extremists to take advantage of these highly unstable environments.
There's also been a long time sort of implicit battle over Syria between the United States and the older Soviet Union, and now the U.S. and Russia, of course. Mark wants to know, what happens if two NATO members get into a military conflict with each other, as could occur between the U.S. and Turkey regarding Kurdish forces?
In fact, there is some anecdotal evidence that we've either come very close to that or that has already happened. In those cases, it hasn't been necessarily the Turks that have been pulling the trigger, but groups that are aligned with the Turks have been shelling forces that are aligned with the United States, what's called the Syrian Democratic Forces, the bulk of which is made up of these Syrian Kurdish fighting force called the People's Protection Units. There is a real concern that in these military actions, an American soldier, a special forces operator who are advisors to these Syrian groups could get killed, or vice versa. And it would create significant problems for the United States in Turkey on the battlefield, as well as a full-blown political and diplomatic crisis between two of the most important members of NATO.
Let me go to another question, and then we'll go to our callers. Lanny wants to know, based on the Trump – this is asking for a pretty subjective opinion – but based on the Trump administration action so far, why should any nation negotiate in good faith with the U.S.?
Well, it's a very important point, especially as the Trump administration moves, as it seems to be doing, to decertify the Iran nuclear deal.
And to go out of the Paris climate deal.
And to go out. Although we haven't technically left the Paris climate agreement. We have announced that we will. But I think the decertification of the Iran nuclear deal in the same vein would suggest that the United States is not reliable, that as flawed as the deal is, this is one of the real downside risks of decertifying and moving away. It, in fact, isolates the United States in the international community and raises the prospects of violence between the United States.
And if the U.S. tries to bring back sanctions, I don't think the other signatories are going to go along with it.
I think it's abundantly clear the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, others will not go along.
Go to more calls. Let me go next Mari. Mari, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call, Michael. And thank you for having such a wonderful discussion. So I just wanted to pinpoint a couple of bird's eye views that we as a country take of conflict. I was born in Kashmir, and a few years ago I went to visit my grandma, and I realized that on the streets there were cars that disseminated a lot of Islamic material sponsored by ISIS in Kashmir, which is a conflicted zone between India and Pakistan and has been for years and years and years. And a lot of training material, a lot of terrorism gets imported from Pakistan, and there's a lot of human rights violation from India. What I was getting at is, when in all of the conflict, including the one in Iraq, Pakistan has played such an amazing and crazy role, because they still have a lot of terrorist camps training going on, which we are very aware of. And yet nobody wants to talk about that country as a main source of arms, ammunition, propaganda, and we're doing nothing about it. Just wanted to have an opinion of your guest.
Well, thanks very much for the question. Let me first start with a caveat that I don't work professionally on Pakistan. What I know about Pakistan, I learned from my friends who do work on Pakistan, and what I read in the newspapers and journals. But I will say that it strikes me that you raise a very, very important point. Pakistan has been unstable and spinning out all kinds of extremist groups, and has been a source of violence in Afghanistan, in India, as well as in the Middle East and Europe. There's been an effort to work with Pakistan on these issues rather than deal with it head on.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll go right to another caller, and that's you, Jacob. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Good morning. As far as the big picture goes, the situation in the Middle East, or America, is often blamed for, I would say, most of the chaos in the Middle East, but it seems that at the end of the day, the sectarian and tribal divisions in the region are the root of the problem. And I would like to hear your guest's opinion on that, and I'll listen off the air.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for the question. Stephen Cook.
Thanks very much. I do think that in a place like Libya, for example, tribal and geographic divisions are things that have contributed to the fragmentation of the country. Although at the same time, I think our emphasis on sectarian differences throughout the region is something that we have appropriated from the actors in the region ourselves, and that they have used this idea to advance their agenda. So, for example, the Saudis, in an almost pathological kind of way, regard the exercises of Iranian power in sectarian terms, in terms of Sunni power versus Shia power. That's dangerous that we have appropriated that kind of language as well, because what it suggests is that when you define a conflict in terms of these identity issues, it's much, much harder to find a resolution to that conflict. And by our accepting this idea of it's just about Sunni and Shia, we are perhaps putting ourselves in a situation where we are engaged in conflict, where there doesn't have to be conflict, where negotiation is possible. But when it's defined in these terms, always, if we see Iraq only in sectarian terms, if we see Saudi Arabia and Iran only in sectarian terms, if we only see Syria in sectarian terms, we are fated to play out these kinds of identity conflicts that are much, much harder to settle and tend to be quite violent.
And also are much more ancient. I mean, you think about Saudi Shia Islam as opposed to Iranian, Saudi Sunni Islam as opposed to Iranian Shia Islam. I'm wondering about the new leadership in Saudi Arabia, though. I mean, now women are driving. I mean, are we moving forward?
Well, I'm not prepared to give the Saudis any credit for finally giving women permission to drive. This was the last country on earth where women were not able to drive. I don't think it necessarily augurs a new, more liberal environment in Saudi Arabia, although it's great for women who do want to drive there. Much of it has to do with economics. Some of it has to do with public relations. And a good deal of it has to do with the fact that the Saudis are engaged in an effort to remake their economy and their politics. And Mohammed bin Salman, the new crown prince, does need as much support in that effort as possible. And my sense is that he's looking for women to be supportive of that.
Well, you spoke before about the focus on Idlib and the memorandum back in May between between Russia and Iran and Turkey. Does that open up hopes for diplomacy for the Syrian war?
Well, I think what it suggests is that diplomacy is still possible in Syria. But at the same time, this diplomacy, the logical conclusion of this diplomacy is the continuation of the Assad regime and the Assad regime's ability to regain control over large pieces of territory in Syria. So much so that important regional actors are suggesting that Assad has actually won this conflict. And it's only a matter of time before he is able to reestablish control over most of Syria.
What do you think, Stephen Cook, about a lot of questions about the U.S. role? And we brought it up because so much in your book about the U.S. role in the Middle East historically and in the present. There are U.S. think tanks, and there's a lot of money coming from foreign governments that have to do with U.S. foreign policy, too.
That's true. Let me just say the Council on Foreign Relations does not accept any foreign any money from any foreign governments. It doesn't accept any money from the U.S. government. It's an independent, nonpartisan research and membership organization. I unfortunately can't say the same for some of the other organizations around town. There are a lot of think tanks and not a lot of money. And I think in some cases, the leadership of these organizations have believed that they can accept donations from foreign governments and entities, yet at the same time maintain their independence. I question the wisdom of that. It has been a significant issue in Washington. I will say, however, if there's a belief that this is buying people's views. If you just look at the conflict between the Emiratis, the Saudis, and the Qataris, all of whom have been involved in major donations to organizations around Washington, it really hasn't made a difference. The Saudis don't own Washington, the Emiratis don't own Washington, and the Qataris don't own Washington.
We'll get another caller on here. Tom, that's you. You're on.
I wanted to share something regarding the epic tragedy, which I consider the slaughter that's occurring in Syria. Your guest made a two-part observation. While it is sad and true that doing nothing, Syria would have and has descended into this cauldron of slaughter. The second portion of his equation, what could the U.S. have done? I wanted to be a bit Pollyannish and a bit impertinent to suggest the solution would have not been in Damascus, but really in Moscow, that Obama missed a golden opportunity to do what Kennedy ended up doing to save the world from the brink with the Cuban Missile Crisis by negotiating with his nemesis.
Tom, excuse me, we're coming up to the end of the program here. I'd like to hear what Stephen Cook has to say about that. In fact, that's kind of what Donald Trump suggested. We can work with Putin and there can be a resolution to the Syrian conflict.
Well, first, like I said, early in the conflict, I felt it was important that the United States contemplate intervening to stave off this humanitarian conflict. But by 2013, it seemed unlikely that the exercise of American power in Syria was going to do much to help anybody. And in fact, put the United States back in the middle of a conflict. Working with the Russians? Yes, but they have supported Assad, the person who's killed almost 500,000 people.
We'll have to leave it there. Stephen Cook, good to have you with us. Stephen Cook, again, is Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations. His book is False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. And he'll be at World Affairs Council tonight at 6:30. And KQED will bring you a special on the Northern California fires next, hosted by Scott Schaefer. Thank you for being a part of this morning's forum. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.